Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, towards an ethical and balanced world economy, the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace issues a document encouraging reform of international financial and monetary systems. And what does silence have to do with communicating the faith? And how can the faithful navigate new media? Our guest shares his ideas on silence and how the new media offer new opportunities for evangelization. The Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace released a document Monday calling for a radical reform of the world's financial and monetary systems. It also proposes the creation of a global political authority to manage the economy and a new world economic order based on ethics. The note, entitled Towards Reforming the International Financial and Monetary Systems in the Context of the Global Public Authority, was presented to journalists at a press conference on Monday, presided over by the president of the council, Cardinal Peter Turkson.
We're talking about finding solutions to issues, finding solutions to problems. And the issue that, you know, faces all of us is this, you know, what again is being referred to as globalization. And it is this phenomenon that we're drawing attention to. Okay, and this phenomenon appears to be something which supersedes in character, in exercise, everything, the competence and the power authority of individual single countries. Then when that is the case, is it the case that these small little countries, everybody should be left at the altar of sacrifice, if you want, of this big phenomenon, which different or whatever groups can make use of? Or is it necessary to also constitute some governing body, or if you want, a referee of similar competence, okay, to deal with this issue? So the suggestion we're making is a very modest one. We're saying that everybody knows about globalization. Everybody feels its impact. But single individual countries don't have the competence to deal with it. So is it necessary then to come together to create a global body to deal with a global phenomenon?
Cardinal Turkson told Lydia O'Kane that the document was also a way of giving a voice to the voiceless.
Definitely, that's part of it. And in fact, in asking the G20, whatever, to pay attention to this or start doing carrying their reflection in this direction, it is actually in view of those who suffer from this phenomenon. So giving voice to a voiceless, that's what it is. I mean, somebody may find this proposal so idealistic and so unrealistic. But that's also part of the nature of being a prophetic or voice. You talk about something that you know and deep down feel convinced that will be good without, at the same time being able to see even how that can come to pass.
The proposal, which is not a papal document, suggests that the reform process might begin with the United Nations as a point of reference.
When the world got out of the Second World War, it found the need to come together to create the United Nations. Because, it found it necessary to come together to be able to deal with something, an evil that they didn't want the world to experience anymore. We find that we're not saying that globalization is an evil experience, no. But we're talking about its dimension, okay? And that's what we're drawing our attention to. In the face with similar phenomenon of that character, is it useful? Would it be useful to have an authority of a similar dimension or similar character to deal with it? That's all we're saying. And we think that since the consciences of the world nations moved them to come together to form a group like the United Nations, it will be up to us now to sit and see, is it adequate? Is it competent enough to deal with this global phenomenon? Or do we need some other thing? Or do we need to reshape, remodel, whatever, to be able to deal with this? So that's what it is. The thing is, let's look at the situation that that confronts all of us, this global phenomenon. At the end of the day, ensuring the well-being of the human person, who is the subject of all of this. And if we talk about his well-being, we're talking about common good. Is it not time to look at how we can manage this global phenomenon so that it brings happiness and a joy or reserve of common good to everybody? That's what we're talking about.
It was mentioned in the document the knock-on effect of the financial crisis, areas such as social justice issues. How concerned are you and your council about that?
the task of our office, or the mandate of our office, is to promote the church's social doctrine. And the church's social doctrine basically is an application of, okay, the Christian faith and the charity of Christ, the love of Christ, to every, you know, social situation. Social issues, that's our business. That's what we exist to do. And what we exist to do is to bring, to shed the light of our Christian faith and the light of the charity of Christ on all social issues. And when this leads to denouncing a situation, we'll denounce it. When this needs to, you know, recommending, or, you know, if you want praising a situation, we'll do that. But basically, that's our job. About it's about the social environment in which the human person lives. So that's very much what we need to do.
Cardinal Peter Turkson is the president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. Well, one of the organizations that has welcomed the publication of the Pontifical Council's note on financial reform is the UK-based Catholic Development and Relief Agency, CAFOD. Lydia O'Kane spoke to CAFOD's economist Christina Weller, who called the document very timely.
Overall reaction at CAFOD is extremely positive. We think it's a very timely document. The G20 is coming up to its summit in Cannes, and once again, it's sort of looking inwards to its internal crises in its own economies. And the document reminds us that there are issues that need to be urgently addressed. They were urgent back in 2008, but they remain unresolved. And that's really why we found ourselves back in a mess without the tools that we need to clean it up.
Is it a case of the Vatican saying things that other people are afraid to say or just aren't saying?
I think it is. I think it's a reminder, particularly to the G20, that they need to look beyond their last lobby meeting and beyond the next elections and have something of a broader vision and be a bit bolder. For example, even back in 2008, we knew that there wasn't a decent way to deal with problems of sovereign debt. And this was one of the issues that was put on the G20's agenda, but they haven't really knuckled down to the sort of more difficult discussions and changes that would be needed to put that in place. And that's why we find ourselves back in the situation where governments are bearing all the risk of public debt and having to find all the solutions, and that risk and those burdens aren't being shared by financial markets.
Just looking at the document itself, and of course there were a number of different points in this document. One in particular was the G20 itself. It was looking at the G20's role. If the G20 is not handling this crisis to the best of its ability, what is the alternative? Who is better to handle it?
I think what the G20 has shown is it is actually pretty good in crisis mode. It's able to do the short-term fixes, what needs to be done now to reassure markets. But I think what it's also shown is that it's less good at fixing the bigger problems that underlie the crises. And those broader problems that the crisis showed us of why economies were performing particularly badly in delivering sort of social progress, economic justice, and environmental protection that the Vatican document reminds us about. And I think a good example is inequality. We know that that's one of the reasons that we ended up in a crisis. There was too much inequality between countries and within countries that led to excess debt in some places, excess wealth in other places, and a lot of volatility. But the G20 hasn't done very much about that. And in fact, we're seeing the development agenda that it launched only last summit in Korea, in Seoul, being sidelined at this summit whilst we go back into crisis mode. And I think that's what the Vatican document reminds us about, that we need to not only deal with crises, but to deal with those bigger problems as well.
Also, the document talked about the United Nations being more of a point of reference. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think the document hits the nail on the head, really. The problem with the G20 and the reason that we keep getting these short-term fixes and minimum interventions is that it's too narrow a range of interests that are represented at the G20. So we see quite a lot of interaction with the business lobby, with the financial lobby, and we see the G20 countries looking to their own national interests and, you know, the same narrow range of ideas that are driving and limiting the agenda. And really what we need and what we would get at the UN is a broader range of stakeholders, a broader range of countries, and I think critically a broader range of ideas than we're getting at the G20 at the moment.
Would you think that issues that you're involved in, certainly poverty, climate change, social justice issues, Are they being lost amidst the whole economic crisis, do you think?
Definitely. I think we've already talked a little bit about how the development agenda has been sidelined, but also climate change was supposed to be one of the issues that would be at the core of the agenda. We're just coming up to a lot of critical negotiations around climate change at the UN. And one of the things that the G20 could and should have done is deliver really good ideas around innovative financing, how we're going to find the money that we urgently need to finance climate adaptation and mitigation. But we're really not going to see that at this summit. We already know that we're likely to get some sort of weak compromise language around certain countries doing certain things and other countries doing other things, which has mostly been driven by vested interests in those countries of the transport and financial sectors. And the Vatican document makes quite a clear statement that these sectors that need to be taxed, the financial sector in particular, needs to be taxed to help pay for things like climate change and development.
I mean, this document, this note, has been called quite a radical document, a hard-hitting document even. I mean, is it likely that G20 leaders in Cannes will take notice of it?
I certainly hope so. And I know, CAFOD, we're going to take a very similar message to the summit ourselves. I think there is an opportunity at this summit. The G20, as part of the agenda for Cannes, is discussing how it works itself, its own governance, plus a broader vision of how global economic issues should be dealt with institutionally. And the Vatican document goes really to the heart of that. So I'm hoping that they'll take it on board and realize that they can start with improvements at home and change the G20's own transparency, the lack of consultation, the need for a broader representation of countries systematically at the G20, but also look longer term and realize that they need institutions that are better suited to the task, that are more inclusive, more democratic, and more visionary to solve these big global economic problems.
In the document, Pope Benedict is quoted from his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, and there was also a quote from him talking about this is a time of risk, but also a time of opportunity to confront this financial crisis. Would that be something you'd agree with?
Yes, I think that was my own reaction reading the Vatican document. This is a real reminder to the G20 of what they said at the London summit. You know, you shouldn't waste a good crisis, and that they are really at risk of doing that. Originally, we saw some really sort of inspiring language and thinking about the need for inclusive growth, balanced growth, more stability, to look at environmental and social impacts of financial markets. And all those ideas seem to have disappeared. And we see the G20 now doing the absolute bare minimum. So they really need to grasp the opportunity of change of a new crisis. We can't just keep going from crisis to crisis. They really need to start tackling those underlying problems.
And thanks there to Christina Weller, an economist for the Catholic Development and Relief Agency, CAFOD. Silence and word, the path of evangelization. That's the seemingly contradictory theme of the Church's World Day for Communications, celebrated each year on the Sunday before Pentecost and on May 20th in 2012. The Pope traditionally releases his message for the occasion on January 24th, the feast day of St. Francis de Sales, the patron saint of writers. Well, when they announced the theme of the 46th World Day, the Pontifical Council for Social Communication said the Holy Father clearly desired to associate it with the October Synod of Bishops, whose own theme is the new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. The Vatican spokesman and director of Vatican Radio, Father Federico Lombardi, recalls Pope Benedict's visit to the Carthusian monastery of Serra San Bruno in Italy's southern Calabria region, a place where he remembers the prior's words that for centuries the lamp of prayer has been kept lit in silence and obscurity.
Non c'è antitesi fra il silenzio e la parola, fra la preghiera e l'annuncio, perché il silenzio è la premessa.
There is no antithesis between silence and word, between prayer and proclamation, for silence is the essential prerequisite for accepting and preparing to hear the word. The sound of the word becomes meaningful precisely because it is interspersed with moments of silence. For the person of today, immersed in a torrent of constant noise, physical and mental, the life of monks inspires admiration and awe, a nostalgic yearning for the rhythm and balance of a way of life lost in the past. In any case, almost everyone feels its charm and understands, at least vaguely, the vital importance of a place where silence is not the equivalent of a void or nothingness, but rather the breath of the spirit, where it becomes possible to perceive the gentle movement of the heavenly spheres, and in the end, the quiet breathing of a light wind of the presence of God. The most real reality there is, as the Pope has said, a reality that lies beyond the perceptible dimension. While we inquire how to give wings to the new evangelization and its messages, we should not forget that their efficacy arises from listening. Their foundation is silence, full of the reality of the life of God. As the prior also said, the hidden existence of the monks who in God experience a closeness to all people of the earth, and especially to those who are seeking, struggling, and suffering, accompanies us and comforts us.
Well, Father Jean-Pierre Ruiz is a biblical scholar and theology professor at St. John's University in New York, and he's an expert in new media. I asked him how silence can be a part of communicating the faith in the digital age.
I think that to choose the theme of silence as the theme for the World Communications Day is strangely eloquent, to tell you the truth, because we live in a world where words, in a certain sense, have become a cheapened commodity, and where people say, very often, much less than they actually mean. I think that by choosing silence and word, path of evangelization, as the theme for 2012 Communications Day, the Pope has told us something about the richer qualities of communication. And in fact, the Church has been about the business of communicating not only by words for a very long time, in fact, from the beginning. I say this because the Church's liturgy, for example, is not just reading, is not just text, is not merely what we say. It's also the attitude of our bodies. It's also sound without words in terms of instrumental liturgical music. It involves the use of all of our senses in terms of the sense of smell, in terms of incense, and the flowers that are used to decorate the sanctuary for the Eucharistic liturgy and for other celebrations. So if we were to reduce communication to words, I think we would be much impoverished.
Well, how does this relate then to the new media? There you have images, you have audio, you have words. How do you see silence operating in that field?
Let me go back to St. Augustine, which might sound like a strange place to start to talk about the new media, but St. Augustine was a student of St. Ambrose. And because in antiquity, students did whatever they could to imitate their teachers, particularly when their teachers were revered, there's a story that is told of Augustine coming upon his teacher Ambrose and being quite surprised by the fact that when Ambrose was reading, he was reading silently. Well, what does this mean? It means that in antiquity, the words that were written on a page of a codex or the page of a scroll, the words were shorthand for oral communication, so that when people read in antiquity, they read to themselves and to each other out loud. Libraries in the ancient world were not places where librarians went around shushing people. The noisier the library was, the more clear an indication was that the library was being appropriately used. Private reading in silence is really only an artifact of much later history. Well, what does this imply for the new media? Well, for one thing, as the internet grew of age, it grew from being principally a text-based means of communication, where people typed things to each other across fairly limited networks, and the people who engaged in this kind of typing had to be people with a certain amount of skill and a certain amount of know-how in terms of using what were the awkward, kludgy, cumbersome technologies of that moment in what is at this point the digital past, to a situation now where by Skype I can talk to and I can see someone either here in Rome or in Indonesia in real time. So the medium has made communication more transparent. And in a certain sense, that has always been the intention of communications media, that is, to facilitate contact between people, to make it possible for people to encounter each other in meaningful ways. It's never been the role of the medium, whether print or otherwise, to stand in the way of quality communication. And the new media have done quite a lot to make communication more accessible, to make communication much more available to a broader population.
It seems to me you hit a key word there, quality. We don't always have quality on the internet, in the new media. We have people expressing opinions as facts. Facts often get distorted, so it's a question of knowing where to go to get the real facts.
There's a wonderful cartoon that appeared in the New Yorker magazine some time ago, and that cartoon depicts a dog sitting at a keyboard in front of a computer, and the caption is, "On the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog." And it's a wonderful way of capturing the way in which, to a certain extent, while the new media reveal quite a lot about the world, the new media can also conceal quite a lot about the interests of the author of a particular website, the interests or the background or the expertise of someone who is presenting information to the world. Now, we like to imagine that in the past, in the old media world, there were ways of vetting, there were ways of quality control that made it possible to identify someone who was an authorized spokesman for this or that viewpoint more effectively. Well, to a certain extent that worked, but to a certain extent that became a product of the ways in which people controlled publication in terms of the expenses, the significant expenses that are associated with publication. Because to print a book, to print a newspaper, requires an enormous infrastructure, a very intricate organization of experts in the manipulation of certain technologies, and requires selling these products to whoever happens to be willing to buy them. The internet has taken the intermediary out of that to a certain extent, which means that people can self-publish, can make information available in this way or in that way without having to invest in or without having to capture the interest of others who are willing to invest in the product that they are marketing. Now, I think net-net that has made information much more available, but at the same time it's made it that much more urgent for us to develop ways in which we can discern what constitutes quality information on the internet. So you know whether you're talking to a person or you're talking to a dog who's pretending to be a person.
We've seen some aspects of the new media in Twitter and Facebook, other media platforms such as those, being used to generate revolutions, the Arab Spring. We've seen it also in the recent violence in the UK. What can governments do, do you think, to prevent the negative aspects of new media from causing social or civil unrest to the extent, not necessarily the positive aspects of what we're seeing in the Arab world, but the negative aspects?
I think that freedom of speech is a very, very important human right and a very, very important human responsibility, because from my understanding on the basis of Catholic social teaching, I understand that rights have their correlatives in responsibilities. I also don't think it's the role of government to limit the communication by their populations, because limitation almost inevitably implies repression. And repression is the enemy of democracy, and repression is the enemy ultimately of human dignity. Now, while it can take time for things to sort themselves out, and while there are people who would use the new media for ends that violate basic human dignity, I don't think that it is appropriate for government to assume the role of monitor in that respect. What is important on the part of faith communities, on the part of the church, on the part of people who are interested in and committed to the value of human dignity, to the principle of solidarity and to the principle of the common good, is a matter of educating people in terms of their lives as consumers of media, that is, of recipients of information, educating people to be discerning in the information that they receive from the internet and from newspapers and from television and from even such an ancient medium as radio, to train them.
I take offense at that, because there are many who would say that there is a future still for radio.
Oh, and I'm quite committed to the future of radio in that, for example, the new media have actually made it possible for radio to be heard and to be used in all sorts of new ways that were never envisioned in the days of Marconi. So it is a medium that has persisted and that has stood the test of time in terms of its adaptability to new technologies, because in the end there's nothing more powerful than the sound of a human voice. There's nothing more powerful than that. And to put a lid on that, to put a limit on the capacity for human beings to express what they really mean and to come into contact with each other by hearing the sound of each other's voices, there's nothing that replaces that. At the same time, as important as it is to educate people with respect to how they receive media, it is important to educate people with respect to their responsibility as communicators, that nothing we say is ever neutral. There's nothing that we say that doesn't need to be thought through in terms of the potential consequences, in terms of the behaviors that can be inspired by the sorts of things that we say. The sorts of things that we can say can lead us, on the one hand, to empathize with, to be in solidarity with someone halfway across the world whom we've never met, but to whom we are bound by our same human condition, and as Christians, by virtue of the fact that we recognize each other as brothers and sisters made by the same God. On the other hand, we know how words can inspire violence, how words can turn people against each other, how the violence of words can lead to bloodshed, and we need to educate people to that reality as well.
Do you think the Catholic Church is effective enough in this area of helping people to discern the negative aspects within the new media and also to educate them about how to receive it?
I think that the Pontifical Council for Social Communications and other entities within the Church globally and the Church in various local settings in many cases have taken the lead in educating people to that. I think that we have a lot yet to learn from the new media, and things move so quickly that this is a growth area for the Church and for the Church's ministries, because it does represent such important new opportunities for evangelization, for catechesis, for getting the word out about what's been called the Church's best-kept secret, which is its social teaching. The popes have made increasing use of electronic media in getting the word out. The late Pope John Paul II, for example, was as much pastor as he was media star, very conscious of the way in which his image and the sorts of things that he said in media moments made a difference in the way in which the Church was perceived and received, not just superficially, but very deeply. And Pope Benedict has followed up on this in the way in which he has encouraged the Pontifical Council for Social Communication and other entities in the Roman Curia and other offices within the Church to use the new media responsibly. The reconfiguration of the Vatican website, for example, is an exciting development and I'm sure is an area that is under considerable growth and development and redevelopment and thinking and rethinking as it becomes more and more a cutting-edge thing. It's my understanding that the Holy See has a YouTube channel, which is, in terms of the new media, a very cutting-edge, not only technology, but outreach to generations that might have been less comfortable with old media venues for receiving words from the Church, who now have not only access to, but the availability of the real thing on the small screen.
And a warm thanks there to Father Jean-Pierre Ruiz, a biblical scholar and theology professor at St. John's University in New York. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.